Right-wing parties are more or less alike. Out front is a charismatic leader, and out the back are the party heavies. Together, they write the rules, set the policies, and choose the candidates. Members are left with nothing much to do but chores. That was One Nation, but with electoral success now staring the party in the face, it has to adapt and grow, or it's doomed to follow the path it's trodden for the last 30 years. Bursts of success, followed by chaos, and yet more years of electoral oblivion. Jordan McSwinney is a senior research fellow at the Centre for Deliberative Democracy at the University of Canberra. A couple of years ago, he wrote the book Far-Right Political Parties in Australia, Disorganisation and Electoral Failure. Since then, he's been keeping a close eye on and writing about One Nation as it faces the perils of success. Jordan joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, David.
In your writing, you argue again and again that little right-wing parties are terrified of being infiltrated, of being taken over.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a perennial fear among many of them of being white-anted, of being, termites coming in and undermining the party from within. And so we see a lot of far-right parties in Australia, like with One Nation, but also around the world, where they have very, very tight organisational structure, investing power in a small number of people within the organisation, to keep it all under control and prevent that fear of being undermined from their opponents.
So how did One Nation organise this from the start?
Yeah, so the origins of One Nation as a political party are somewhat scandalous and rather interesting, I think. But the organisation was very concerned with being undermined. So they established actually three distinct legal entities when they first formed in 1998. One of those was a company to sort of hold the assets. Another, the Pauline Hanson's One Nation, was a political party registered with the Australian Electoral Commission to contest elections. And the third organisation at the time was called the Pauline Hanson Support Movement Incorporated. The political party had only three members, Pauline Hanson and her two co-founders, the Davids. When people signed up, paid their membership fee, thought they were joining the party, they were actually joining that third organisation, the Pauline Hanson Support Movement. And this got them in quite a lot of legal hot water.
Let's examine that legal hot water, shall we? So first of all, they registered with the Australian Electoral Commission. One Nation registered and swore that they had not three, but 500 members or more.
Yeah, so at the time, the requirement to register was you needed to show a list of about 500, a minimum of 500 members of the party. One Nation provided documents that suggested they had over 1,000. But the devil's in the detail, and those members were not actually members, technically, of Pauline Hanson's One Nation political party, as registered with the AEC. They were actually members of the Pauline Hanson Support Movement, which the AEC did not look very kindly upon. And so there was a subsequent trial.
No, just a minute. Let us stay with the Australian Electoral Commission at the moment. So the Australian Electoral Commission found, and it's still on the books, that the registration of One Nation was achieved, the application was made, knowing it was false or recklessly not caring whether it was true. And that still remains on the books. And as a result, Pauline Hanson and her colleagues had to return how much money to the Australian Electoral Commission?
It was roughly $500,000.
Roughly $500,000. And they've never got that money back, have they?
No, though no. They've made plenty since.
Yes, but she was subsequently charged with fraud and convicted and sent to jail.
Yeah, indeed. Quite famously, she would describe herself as Australia's first political prisoner. Although it's worth noting that conviction was overturned about 3 months later.
Yes. So the criminal conviction was overturned, but the judgment of the Australian Electoral Commission remains on foot about that original registration. Now, they changed the policy. They changed the constitution of the party.
Yeah. So Hanson actually left the party before she went to prison. So she left the party in 2002, went to prison in 2003, had a period in the political wilderness. She founded some other political parties, including the Pauline Hanson's United Australia Party, a name that would later come up with Clive Palmer. When she returned to the party, returned to the parliament in 2016.
Who do we have to thank for her getting back into parliament in 2016?
Malcolm Turnbull, I'd say. The double dissolution, I think it's quite plausible that had that not taken place, that double dissolution election, which effectively halves the threshold for a quota, so it makes it much easier to get elected, it's entirely plausible that actually none of the four One Nation members elected at that election would have taken their seats. So
now there's a new constitution for the party.
Yes.
Yeah, so, and how does it protect Pauline Hanson?
Yeah, so the party was redrafted their constitution, which, for context, all political parties have to have a set of rules or a constitution that govern how they operate internally. It's a requirement of the Electoral Commission to register a political party. So what they did in 2017, after Hanson and three colleagues enter Australian Parliament, they introduced a new clause in the constitution that enshrines the presidency of the leadership of the party on Pauline Hanson for life, along with the subsequent powers to handpick her successor. And this is really unusual in the Australian political party context.
I was talking about this show on air earlier today, and I said she had the same situation as the Pope, office for life. But you point out something that the Pope doesn't have, which is the right to appoint her successor.
Yeah, and there's no, you know, exciting conclave for the One Nation leadership either. So I guess we're both losing out. They're both losing out there. But yes, exactly. The Pope is not able to handpick their successor. Pauline Hanson is.
Now, we're talking about all political parties now. Jordan, the constitution of a political party, does it have to be public?
There is not a requirement that the AEC publishes it. A party might choose to put it on their website. They might choose to send it out to their members. It's simply a requirement that it exists and it's submitted to the AEC at the time of registration.
But One Nation has published its constitution.
At some points in history. It's not constantly available, we'll put it that way.
Right. Okay. And is there, because so much public money turns on this, is there a definition at the Australian Electoral Commission of what a member is, what rights a member of a political party should have?
No, there's no legal definition of what a political party member is. It's really up to parties themselves to think about the rights, roles and responsibilities of a member. And indeed, that's a key part of why they have constitutions, to lay that kind of stuff out.
Right. So what powers do members of One Nation, now no longer supporters, but actually members. Of course, they were always told they were members in the past, but now they really are members. What can they do inside the party?
Well, on paper, being a party member allows you access to things like local branch meetings. It allows you to come along to the annual general meeting of the political party. It allows you to stand as a candidate for the party and stand for various sort of internal office bearer roles, like becoming the treasurer or becoming, you know, taking on some other kind of administrative position within the party. That's in theory. Whether that actually happens in practice is then a separate question, right? These party rules, there's no one else to enforce them. It's up to the party themselves. So if, for whatever reason, they decide not to follow it, no one's going to hold them accountable for that.
Right. So at the end of this week, the Labor Party is gathering. Hundreds of members will gather and they will debate policy.
Mm.
Do the members of One Nation gather and debate policy?
Well, in theory, the annual general meeting of the party is an opportunity to do that. And certainly various members of the party administration have at times talked about the AGM as this kind of forum for members to interact, have their say, vote on matters that matter to the party.
But does it really?
It's hard to get inside those things. You hear differing reports and differing accounts from various characters in and around the party, certainly around the, say, 2019 convention, or the AGM rather. There were a lot of complaints from former members and candidates that there was no meaningful voting on policy positions or positions within the party administration, and some quite famously blew up with the party and left as a result. Other figures in One Nation would dispute that. They suggest that that's a false recollection, that indeed there was votes on the floor. The key point, though, in all of this is that, much like the presence of a constitution, the having an AGM is also just a legal requirement of political parties in Australia. So it shouldn't be read necessarily as an indicator of the democratisation of the party or necessarily as a vehicle for members to have their say. It really is just a legal requirement at the end of the day.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr and I'm talking to Jordan McSwinney, who is the author of the book Far-Right Political Parties in Australia, Disorganisation and Electoral Failure. Now, Jordan, far-right parties, as you describe them, don't have branches.
Well, they do now. One Nation is in the process of setting up one in every single lower house electorate in the country.
Is that going to be possible for them?
It's a huge challenge. I mean, that's a massive upscaling of the party organisation to have 151 local branches. Whether they can pull that off, I think, is very much an open question. Certainly, there have been some seats where they've had a vibrant party on the ground for some time, like the Hunter in New South Wales. But, you know, are they going to be really setting up active, vibrant, ongoing local branches in, say, inner metropolitan seats where it's their polling is not so high? An open question.
What does the what do the Hunter Valley members get for being a vibrant and energetic branch? Anything much?
It's unclear. Certainly there's a sense perhaps that they feel they're involved in the party. They feel that Hanson listens to them. I mean, when you speak with party members, when you speak with party candidates, and in the reporting around the party, one of the big thing that One Nation members sort of point to is the accessibility and authenticity of Hanson. They feel that she's listening. They feel that they can shape the party's direction. They feel they can go up and, you know, have a chat to her at the pub and she'll take on board what they say. Whether that actually happens, whether that's then implemented, carried up the line, et cetera, doesn't seem to be so important.
Do they select the candidates that are going to stand in their seats?
Historically, no. Although in Farrah, with the pre-selection of David Farley, the candidate that was successful there for One Nation at the recent by-election, for the first time in One Nation's history, they actually had a local branch engage in the pre-selection process. So that's quite a turning point in One Nation. Whether that's going to take place in other electorates, and say, for example, in the Victorian branch of the party ahead of the Victorian state election later this year, have to wait and see.
Now, Farley was, of course, elected and has now a member of the House of Representatives for One Nation, its only representative in the House of Representatives. Now,
Joyce.
Oh, of course, Joyce.
But the only one to win a seat.
The only one to win a seat as a One Nation candidate.
Exactly.
Okay, Joyce is there, of course. Two of them, a duumvirate. Now, One Nation has a long record of electing members to parliaments in Australia. An extraordinary number to the Queensland Parliament in 1998, at the time of her problems with the Australian Electoral Commission, and thereafter, here and there. Something like, before the latest members were elected in South Australia and Farley was elected to the House of Reps, One Nation has put about 30 members into Australian parliaments, rather more than people remember, 30. But at least 22 of those split with the party. Now, why was this? And is there any suggestion that whatever was provoking people to just get out of the party, whether anything's being done to address that problem?
No, there's really not. Because the key thing that all of these people who have blow-ups with the party for various reasons tend to come back to is complaints about the internal operation of the party, that it's not democratic enough. And that quite famously was the reason for the collapse of the party's 98 Queensland Senate parliamentary party. There were requests for transformation of the party organisation, democratisation, didn't happen. They all kind of split with the party. The broader picture and what's behind that as well is effectively Hanson and falling outs with Hanson and her style of managing the party and the way in which she has a very top-down autocratic approach to party organisation. So whether it's Mark Latham, the former New South Wales leader of the party, splitting with Hanson in 2023.
Well, this was after Hanson demoted him.
Now, yes, and actually,
let's be reminded of that story.
Yeah, so Hanson, quite extraordinarily, again, in the context of Australian politics, and an excellent example of the highly centralised, national-oriented, top-down approach of the party. She actually dissolved the entire state executive of the New South Wales Party and also basically gave the boot to Mark Latham.
And her reason for doing this?
Yeah, the really vile homophobic comments he made to Alex Greenwich, the local Sydney councillor, that Hanson finally kind of drew a line under, which I think is interesting in the context of someone like Corey Bernardi, the South Australian state leader's historic comments linking homosexuality to bestiality that he continues to refuse to apologise for.
So there's this very interesting contradiction here. The party is Pauline Hanson. Mm. It has never succeeded in its attempts to run without her. Mm-hmm. It needs her. She's the party. And she is the problem once members are elected.
Yeah, I've often said that Hanson is the party's key strength, but also its greatest weakness. I mean, she is the reason, as you say, that they've been able to be electorally successful. She is the reason, effectively, that people vote for the party, that want to join the party, want to stand for the party, and she is absolutely central to their brand. I mean, when you think One Nation, you think Pauline Hanson, right? But her leadership style, her kind of abrasive, I guess, approach to managing her parliamentary colleagues, if we can take the word of those former parliamentary colleagues at face value, is the biggest handbrake on One Nation's success or capacity to translate polling spikes into seats. As you noted earlier, One Nation, really, it doesn't lose its elected members to a vote. It loses them because they split with the party because of a disagreement with Hanson every single time.
It's not policy.
Well, sometimes it is policy. Sometimes it is policy disagreements or disagreements on negotiations on policy in Parliament. So Brian Burston famously was being pushed by Hanson to vote in one direction, but he said he'd made a handshake agreement with the then Liberal government to vote a different direction, and he said his handshake was his word or his sort of honour, and so he split with Hanson over that one. But yes, it typically ultimately comes down to how she actually manages those relationships. And this is a party of big personalities too, so it's sort of, there's a lot of tinder there.
That's true of right-wing parties as well, isn't it? If they have any measure of success, they are around big personalities.
Oh, very much so. I mean, these parties are highly charismatic, for lack of a better word. The kind of big, boisterous personalities are really key at driving their vote and their appeal. I think some of the best examples we could point to outside of Australia would be someone like Nigel Farage in the UK, Donald Trump in the US. Also, like Hanson, an interesting sort of career moving around media and reality television as well. There's kind of something in the mix
here. Yes, there are parallels there.
Yeah. There's something in the mix with reality telly and far-right politicians, perhaps. But certainly that kind of big capacity to kind of command the stage and command the room, never take a step back, never apologise, the sort of Teflon Trump image, that's really quite key and somewhat universal across far-right political parties.
And is it your view that the charismatic leader counts for much more than that leader's policies?
Oh, definitely. I think particularly a party like One Nation, you would have heard, it's a party of grievance, not policy, right? It's about emotional appeals to supporters, members, potential voters, rather than, costed technocratic policy substance. So it's really about making an emotional connection with audiences and sort of bringing them along that journey with you to the polls and hopefully translating that into seats if you're Pauline Hanson.
So in the United States, core support for Trump, recruited by him saying, you've had it tough and you've been betrayed and I'm going to be on your side and things are going to change for you, that has survived the spectacle of him hobnobbing with the rich, giving the rich extraordinary privileges in United States law. That survived. Can Pauline Hanson survive the spectacle of her hobnobbing with the very rich?
Yeah, I think that's a big question of the last couple of weeks in news, really, isn't it? I think in a way, probably. I think there's a degree of, you know, this aspirational view of like, good on your love, get out there, you know, don't let the media kick you down kind of thing. And so I think she will be able to fly straight through with, you know, attending a Dolce & Gabbana show, traveling to Sicily with Gina Reinhardt, being given a plane, that sort of stuff. It doesn't seem to dint her brand, which, when the brand is authentic, political outsider, I understand what ordinary people think. It's a really glaring contradiction, but one that so far she's been able to manage quite successfully.
Is it because the followers of right-wing parties want their leaders to be powerful? That is the key demand, that they be powerful. And the sight of Pauline Hanson riding around in a mining magnate's plane and swimming in a Sicilian swimming pool with her, that means power.
Yeah, look, I'm sure it's got something to do with it. I think the biggest thing, though, really is this sense of being a political outsider, of kind of taking the fight to the establishment parties, as Hanson would put it, taking the fight to, as they would put it, traditional media, and this idea that she's kind of straight talking, this ordinariness, this idea that she's going to say what everyone's thinking. And I think it's this quite confected, I would say, authenticity that is really the key appeal for Hanson among her supporters.
Jordan, if you were advising Angus Taylor, what do you think is the strategy that can bring One Nation down?
Yeah, I think parties of any stripe in Australia, you underestimate Hanson and One Nation at your own peril. I think they present a more significant challenge than either party has really taken seriously to this point, and that's to their own detriment. I think the biggest challenge that the Liberal Party has faced in trying to take the fight to One Nation is that they haven't tried to take the fight to One Nation. They have been very much tiptoeing around questions around like the monoculture debate, around immigration, and essentially trying to say to prospective One Nation voters, we'll give you something similar, but you can trust us to deliver it because we have governing experience. And I just think that's not a very strong point of differentiation because, as Hanson herself would say, why go for the copy when you can have the original? So I think trying to ape One Nation's policies, really puts the Liberal Party at a disadvantage. You're never going to be able to outbid One Nation on the right flank on something like immigration, let's say. And it also shifts the debate and the political battle to One Nation's preferred territory. I think what the Liberals are starting to do at the moment and move the discussion more into sort of dry economic policy, that's not territory One Nation's comfortable in. So trying to fight them on immigration is, I think, a disaster, whereas trying to take the fight to them in a space they're not comfortable, greater possibility for movement there.
But the big difference between the party a few years ago and One Nation now is money.
Yeah, it's the big difference. You know, having Australia's richest woman, Gina Reinhardt, full-throated support for the party, financial support for the party, is a massive legitimising event. It's also the financing can provide such a higher level of professionalisation in terms of consultants and third-party operators who can come in and help with social media, campaign messaging, focus groups, all the research that goes into a political campaign.
Building branches on the ground?
Potentially, certainly building the back end for your digital ecosystem. So it provides them a level of resourcing they've never ever had as a minor party. And that's going to be a real big step for them in terms of becoming a slicker and more competitive electoral machine. But I think that's also perhaps where some of the biggest risk for the party lies, because as you become a slicker, more professional, smoother operating political party, well, you stop looking like the little guy. You stop looking like the outsider who's here to shake things up in the Canberra bubble. You actually just start looking like all the politicians that you say you're there to take the fight to.
Do you think Barnaby Joyce is comfortable?
Well, Barnaby has said he's very comfortable. He's given numerous interviews just saying how great a relationship he has with Hanson. There's a part of me that always thinks if you have to come out and tell us how much you love your boss, you probably don't love working with your boss so much at the moment. But, you know, I do wonder if he expected to have so much heat when he stepped across. But I don't expect he's going to jump ship anytime soon.
Jordan, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks, David.
I've been talking to Jordan McSwinney, who is the author of the book Far-Right Political Parties in Australia, Disorganisation and Electoral Failure. It's really fascinating study of what's happening out on the right in this country.